In a world filled with spyware, ransomware, phish, and more, we need you to be the hero. In this podcast, Information Protection and Security is bringing new ways to fight back against the dangerous actors looking to do digital and physical harm. We'll give you everything you need to know on a different topic of risk every month. Coming to you from IPS with Love.
Welcome. This month, we're talking about how to go beyond passwords to protect your accounts. I'm Lisa Waddle.
And I'm John Nekrasov. And today, we're going to share some tips, like Lisa said, about how to protect your accounts using multi-factor authentication. But first, Lisa did an interview with a member of our legal team on ways to responsibly use AI at home. So let's listen in.
Great.
Today, we're talking with Rachel Goodrich, and she is Senior Tech Counsel at HCA Healthcare. You're going to talk a bit about how your family is taking advantage of ChatGPT and some of these other large learning models, but without sacrificing privacy, right?
That's right.
Great.
It's so good to be here.
Yeah, wonderful
Thank
to have you.
You.
Well, we need to start by saying that at HCA Healthcare, we do not allow any experimentation right now, right, with large language models, which means ChatGPT, Gemini, some of these other
Correct. So there are certain employees or departments that may have procured LLMs for specific work use cases that have gone through RAI Governance Council review. Mm-hmm. They've been approved. And of course, we have the contracts in place and the operational procedures in place to make sure we're protecting sensitive data. Mm-hmm. But the publicly available ones that were experimenting with at home, those are not ones that are approved for use by employees for HCA purposes. And of course, that's because we want to make sure that we are protecting sensitive data at HCA, and that while we encourage AI use, it has to be through this governance process that we've set up so that we're making good choices and following, you know, the right practices when we're using
these
tools.
Because it is so new, people might not realize that they could be exposing patient data or their data or even intellectual property. So those are really big areas that if someone's just out there kind of playing around on a work computer, they may not be aware of what they're exposing.
Correct.
So what we're talking about is home use or personal device use. Mm-hmm. So tell me a bit, how have you and your family used these large language models?
So I'll start with my kids, who have grown up with some of these technologies, right? So we use the Alexa. It's in a central place in our home. We do not have them in private spaces in our home. So, you know, the kids at one point asked if they could have them in their bedrooms as alarm clocks.
Oh.
And I reminded them that Alexa's listening sometimes, even when we don't think she is. Mm. So I was not comfortable with that, with no judgment to families who choose them, who make that choice for themselves. But they have grown up using that type of voice-assisted technology, which relies on artificial intelligence and learning models. So the leap to using ChatGPT and some of these other newer technologies hasn't been as great.
Yeah, that's interesting. So that's kind of the gateway, Alexa, for them.
That's right.
And they're actually, probably this whole generation, is more comfortable than the older generation, which has to kind of get used to like asking a question and getting an answer.
That's right. And it's interesting because even in our home, the kids know. So if we don't want to turn Alexa on, but we're trying to talk about her and how we might use her. So let me give an example so it sounds doesn't sound so shady. But, you know, in the morning, we're having breakfast and I might remind the kids to ask A. I won't say her name because then she'll start listening to our breakfast conversation. Don't forget to ask A for the weather before you go get dressed. So you know what you need to be wearing that's seasonally appropriate.
Yeah.
So that, you know, those types of things. But so they already have embedded in them the some of the guardrails of being aware about the information that is being, you know, provided to the technology.
Yeah.
And that we need to be conscientious about what that information is. So
another
example would be, you know, sometimes Alexa will even solicit information. And so I've told the kids that they don't need to have these individual profiles. I don't want Alexa knowing their voice, that is tied to their name, that is tied to their birth date, because that is not necessary for the things we want to use this technology for.
For the weather. Yeah.
For the weather. That's right.
Right, right. No, and those are good lessons, right, that everyone needs to realize. Now, remind me, how old are your kids?
Sure. My son is 12. My daughter is almost 10.
Okay. So, wow, they're still young, very young.
Yes.
But talk about some of the real successes you've had with using ChatGPT in your family.
Of course. So ChatGPT has been great for my daughter, who is still in elementary grade, school grade. And so she has spelling and vocabulary tests. And every week there's a new vocabulary list. And so my husband, to change it up for her, thought, well, why don't we have ChatGPT create a story using your vocabulary words, right? Just a more interesting way rather than just reading the word and the definition, but have it in context in a story to help her appreciate the nuance to the words and the definitions. And so that was really good for her because she, you know, he could cater it to her interests, right? Like, write me a story using these words, and Taylor Swift and, you know, Selena Gomez are the main characters, or whatever it is you want it to be.
Well, and that's a great example of using this technology, using AI to assist with learning, not to do the learning for you.
That's
not to write a paper for you. Yeah.
That's right. And so that's a good kind of tie-in back to how Alexa's used, because you know, my kids know that she can be there to check your work, but not do your work. So once you've done your math homework, you can confirm with Alexa that this equation, you solved it correctly, but she's not the first stop to completing the worksheet.
Okay.
So, you know, other things we've used ChatGPT for, travel itineraries. So give us 3 days in San Francisco, traveling with kids. We want 2 activities a day.
Wow.
And, you know, we can even put in, we include a stop for ice cream. And then it's a good starting point, right? It's not, this doesn't create the what you're going to live by, but it's a good starting point. And it's kind of, you know, we used to crowdsource for travel for information from friends. Right, or AAA. I remember calling AAA, and which is kind of, I don't know that everyone listening to this will know what AAA is for travel, but now we can let these large language learning models do that crowdsourcing for us.
Oh, I love that. Well, and obviously, I know anyone who's read anything about ChatGPT and these other other tools out there knows that there are some cautions, right? That they're not perfect. Do you have any examples of where you tried to use it and it just didn't work out?
So one that comes to mind that really impacts my household is around dietary restrictions. So my husband and children were all diagnosed in 2024 with celiac disease, which comes with a pretty significant lifestyle change in diet that has impacted our household, really. We're a gluten-free household now. And at Halloween, you know, where is the kid's first Halloween post-celiac diagnosis, and we were trying to prepare for how to make this occasion of, you know, just like copious amounts of candy consumption not be a real bummer for them. And we talked to, in advance about, let's go in knowing what candy is gluten-free. So when you're trick-or-treating, you know, when
if you have a choice.
Right. Or, if you have the opportunity, you know, to pick this versus that. And they went to Google, as one does, and started looking that up. And, you know, the initial results that will pop up in a Google search now are from AI Labs, Google AI Labs. And it's not great. It's not always accurate for those questions around dietary restrictions because, you know, whether something is gluten-free does not necessarily mean that it's safe for celiac, individuals with celiac disease. And so we quickly realized, like, we had to do some more, just like you, for any type of research you do, there have to be guardrails. And so, you know, you don't want to go to Wikipedia as your single source of information, the AI results in your Google search may not be sufficient, and let's not rely on those. So go down a little bit further on the page and look for the results coming from celiac.org or some of the other professional organizations that do the vetting around ingredients and manufacturing.
Well, I mean, that makes total sense. You really don't want to rely on that for medical advice something like, I mean, that's the kind of mistake that could really have bad effects.
For sure.
So what a great lesson.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because for it's started out as something just really specific to Halloween candy, but it's had broader application and implications for the kids, really for the whole family, in how we rely on what the internet is telling us.
Yeah, and you know, I'm a former journalist, so I love this idea of looking to sources.
Yes.
Because, I think we get, it can be too easy to look at Google, look at the first couple of responses, you know, even now that they're AI, are often their sponsored sources.
That's right.
Really see where are they pulling that from, and is that somebody that I can trust, with my health or with something important.
Right, and just like you would have for in your journalism days, often not relied on a single source. I mean, the AI results, that is just one source of information. And so do we want to rely on a source? Usually not. I mean, I'm not getting my news from a sole source.
Right.
I get news from different outlets so that I can do the critical thinking.
Yeah.
And make my own judgments or
understanding. Come to your own conclusions.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, I think, it's so interesting because I feel like with your children, they're getting trained in how to ask these questions too.
Yes.
And I know that's something I've really had to learn is how to write prompts, right? And how what things different things you can say. For instance, if you get an answer from ChatGPT, you can say, cite your sources for me. Where did you get this information? Or even ask them to answer you in a certain style, right? I want a chatty email that I'm going to send to my friend about this topic, or I need a business email or a formal cover letter.
Absolutely.
So the tone is different. But you can try with experimenting. I think that's where that comes. You can try a lot of different things. And there's lots of advice out there on how to be better at writing prompts, which is certainly going to be a whole career, I think, going forward. A skill we don't have.
It will be. And it's I'm just excited and fascinated to see what that looks like for my kids, because they will be entering high school when all of these technologies are pretty, well implemented and widely used.
Yes.
And so it's something that their educators and us as their parents are going to have to become comfortable with and figure out how can we support the use and keep it safe and make sure that we are, not removing the human from the loop.
Right.
Continuing to think critically about the outputs. And that's really, it's really very important.
I mean, that's great advice. I love that. It's not a black or white. Don't use it. Or use
that's
it,
right.
I love the idea of guardrails and some guidance on it. So, experiment on your personal devices. Have some fun.
That's right. On your personal devices.
Thank you
so
much.
In your free time.
Yes, that's right.
Not at work.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks to Rachel for joining us. We know everyone has questions about artificial intelligence and how it interacts with security, both at work and at home. And with it being such a hot topic these days, we thought it would be worthwhile to kind of hear someone talk about how they think about both the legal and privacy risks of using artificial intelligence.
Yeah, and it was great to hear from a mom about how she uses AI with her kids. So in last episode, we talked about passwords, which affect everyone pretty much every day. But passwords aren't enough to fully protect your accounts, right?
That's right. And honestly, that's super annoying, to be honest. I mean, when we really think about it, we talked about passwords for 15 minutes last month and provide you to a lot of tips with how the lengths you have to go to protect your passwords.
To make a good
password.
But
the reality is passwords aren't enough. And we're going to talk about why in this episode. And we're going to talk about the different ways that you can secure your identity beyond passwords.
Okay. So beyond passwords, that's where MFA comes in, right? Multi-factor authentication. So we want to talk about briefly what it is and also why you should choose to do it whenever you can, right? So explain a little how MFA works.
Right. So I think basically to explain it, we have to talk about how your password works. So when you log into your account, you put your username in, that's you saying, like, this is the account I'm trying to log into. And then you only provide one kind of layer of authentication, one key to unlock your account, and that's your password. And people talk about authentication in sort of three categories, either something you know, so like your password, something you have, or something you are. And we'll get into each of those categories throughout this conversation. But basically what two-factor authentication or multi-factor authentication does is it doesn't just ask for a password, it asks for something else to kind of extra verify that you are who you say you are. And that's how we can kind of think about all the methods we're going to talk about today.
Right, right. Layering, we talk about kind of, you know, passwords being a key. You can also think about it like, you know, it's like putting on sunscreen, but then putting on a shirt as well, so that you're doubly protected. And in the different ways of MFA, you mentioned know, have, or are, it's all about providing extra proof, right, that you are who you say you are. So MFA may sometimes feel like a hassle, but it really is protecting us, right? If someone gets our password, it keeps them from getting into our bank account because they don't maybe have that second piece, which could be a text that comes to your phone that you then need to go type in. Or it could be something a lot more personal, right? A fingerprint or facial identity. And that's something that's going to be a lot harder for a criminal to get.
Right. Well, think about it. Like if you go into the DMV, for example, and you're trying to get some kind of document, you know, verified and something like that, or trying to get a new license or something, like you'll show them your license and they'll look at your face, right, and just say, like, is this the same person? And you can kind of think about it in that way, that when you're trying to protect your account, you know, if you just use your password, even if it's secure, criminals have ways to sometimes bypass your password or to steal your password through phishing or something like that. So if they get that password and that's protecting all your accounts, then, like, in theory, you could be in serious trouble. And that's why we recommend MFA. So that's why, like, for example, iPhone users, most of the time you use Face ID to open your phone. And that's a way to something you are, right? a physical key. So you know your passcode to your phone, and you also know, you also just have your face.
You have your face.
Right. And no one else has your face, right? And so that kind of is a really great way to authenticate.
And easy, right? Not having to get a code, look at the code, type it in. Simply looking, even though, you know, facial ID or even fingerprints can have little glitches, like if you're wearing glasses or you have a mask on, or maybe if you don't fingerprint it just right, sometimes it'll take a few times. But that inconvenience is really worth it. According to the National Cybersecurity Alliance, MFA protects an account 99% better than just a password. And that's kind of amazing. But there are also other types of MFA that can protect your accounts even more, right?
Right. So I think naturally we think about MFA in relation to those, like, those codes you get on your phone when you put in, like, text my phone number, you get a code back, and then you show it to the website, you put it in, and then you're allowed to enter. And that is more secure than just having your password. But criminals also, unfortunately, as in all, they're very... they have a lot of ways to get at us. And there's been a scam called SIM swapping that's been going around for the last couple of years, where criminals basically try to get access to your phone number. And if they can get access to your phone number, then they can actually hijack those text codes into your phone. So we actually recommend, you know, facial or fingerprint ID is pretty secure. We also recommend getting an authenticator app, like Google Authenticator or Microsoft Authenticator. And those are basically apps that you actually have on your phone. So that goes into the have category, where something physical that's like tied to your physical device, and it has rotating codes that you'll put in. Like, you'll take your phone out, open the app up, and then put that code that's kind of regenerating itself over
always
time
changing,
into
yeah.
the website.
Right, right. And those apps are free and easy enough to download from the app store. So how would I go about getting an app or choosing an app? And an authenticator app, I should say, yeah.
So Google and Microsoft both have reputable ones that you can use and are compatible with a lot of major websites. Not every account is compatible with what's called one-time passcodes. But most of them, most big ones are with those two. And then you can also look around and see if there are others that kind of fit your needs better than those two major ones.
Yeah, a lot of the tech sites have done reviews on authenticator apps. So some, they all have different pluses and minuses. But OTP, yeah, I like that. That's the next acronym we need to know about, OTPs.
Yeah, so ultimately, I think what you need to do as someone who's trying to protect your accounts is just have multiple ways to prove your identity. If everything ultimately ends up with one point of failure, like, there's a higher risk that someone will steal that password and then access your accounts.
Kind of like Murphy's Law. If something can go wrong, it will. If someone can access one point, they will. So assume that and have a backup, right?
Right.
Great.
Exactly right. Huh? Well, thanks for watching and listening on Media Connect and on all major podcast platforms. Subscribe for monthly episodes of From IPS with Love to get much more on cybersecurity and the dangers of the information security world.
Great. Thanks.